We now present the third program in the Book Festival series on Poets of Tomorrow. The series, coordinated by Babette Deitch, poet and author of Animal, Vegetable, and Mineral, features the readings from the works of the younger poets. And now to introduce today's guest, here may we present Miss Deitch.
As you know, this series of poetry readings is called Poets of Tomorrow. So it seems appropriate that you should hear from a young poet, Mae Swenson, whose work appears in a book recently published by Scribner's under the title Poets of Today. That volume introduces the work of three poets. Each one has given a title to his or her group of poems. Mae Swenson has entitled her group Another Animal. Perhaps some of my sympathy with her work can be gauged by the fact that my own most recent book of poems is called Animal, Vegetable, Mineral. Apparently, Mae Swenson and Babette Deitch have kindred interests and attitudes. I think of man as unique in being an imaginative animal. That, above all, is what makes him an artist. If he uses language imaginatively, he is a poet. Mae Swenson is one. Miss Swenson was born and educated in Utah, but for some years she has been living and working here in New York. She says that she leads the life of an office worker from 9 to 5 and the life of a poet from 5 to 9. But to judge by the sharpness of her imagery, Miss Swenson's poetic imagination is awake most of the time. Her poems have appeared in a number of periodicals and several anthologies. In 1953, she won the Poetry Introductions Prize at the YMHA Poetry Center. Her poems afford several kinds of interest. For one thing, they communicate her own lively pleasure in what her 5 senses have to offer. And she has a gift for metaphor. She is able to see things in an unusual way, and so to make you see them with a fresh eye. Her imagination is playful, and her poems invite you to enter into the game with her. At the same time, it is thoughtful poetry. The meanings are not always there on the surface, though you can enjoy the poem without troubling about its deeper significance. Nevertheless, some of her most interesting work requires more attention than a single hearing permits. For that reason, I have asked her to do an unusual thing in poetry broadcasts, indeed in any broadcasts, and that is not merely to comment on one of her poems, but to read it for you twice. I take pleasure in presenting Mae Swenson.
The first poem gives 9 symbolic definitions of love. Love is a rain of diamonds in the mind, the soul's fruit sliced in two, a dark spring loosed at the lips of light, under earth waters unlocked from their lurking to sparkle in a crevice parted by the sun, a temple not of stone but cloud, beyond the heart's roar and all violence, outside the anvil-stunned domain, unfrenzied space, between the grains of change, blue permanence, one short step to the good ground, the bite into bread again. The next poem contains the thoughts of a person watching a lion in the zoo. Lion, in the bend of your mouth, soft murder. In the flints of your eyes, the sun-stained openings of caves. Your nostrils breathe the ordained air of chosen loneliness. Magnificently maned as the lustrous pampas, your head heavy with heraldic curls, wears a regal frown between the brows. The wide bundle of your chest, your loose-skinned belly frilled with fur, you carry easily, sinuously pacing on suede paws. Between tight thighs, under the thick root of your tufted tail, situated like a full-stoned fruit beneath a bough, the quiver of your never-used malehood is slung. You pace in dung on cement. The bars flick past your eyeballs, fixed beyond the awestruck stares of children. Watching you, they remember their fathers, the frightening hairs in their father's ears. Young girls remember lovers too timid and white. And I remember how I played lion with my brothers under the round yellow grain table, the shadow our cave in the lamplight. Your beauty burns the brain, though your paws slew on foul cement. The feet are of captivity you do right to ignore. The bars, too, an illusion. Your heroic paranoia plants you in the Indian jungle, pacing by the cool waterhole as dawn streaks the sky. And the foretaste of the all-day hunt is sweet as yearling's blood in the corners of your lips. Horses in Central Park. This is an impression of horses cantering along the bridle path in the park. There are 12 horses forming a parade of color and texture as they move past the eye. Colors of horses like leaves or stones, wealthy textures, liquors of light. Skin of a plum that's more than ripe, sheathes a robust cloven rump. Frosty plush of lilies for another's head. Ears and nostrils funneled are their cones. Of sere October leaves, this gaunt roan's hide, freckled dun and red. Here's a mole gray back and darker dappled haunch, tail and forelock mauve like smoke. This coal-colored stallion, flake of white on his brow, is slippery silk in the sun. Fox red bay and buckskin blonde as wheat, burgundy mare with tasseled mane of jet, sober chestnut burnished by his sweat to veined and glowing oak. Seal brown pony with white face and feet, pinto in patched and hooded domino. Naked palomino is smooth peeled willow, or marble under water, or clean morning snow. Here's a more personal poem called Question. I'd like to read it, say a word about it, and then read it again. Question. Body my house, my horse, my hound. What will I do when you are fallen? Where will I sleep? How will I ride? What will I hunt? Where can I go without my mount all eager and quick? How will I know in thicket ahead is danger or treasure when body my good bright dog is dead? How will it be to lie in the sky without roof or door and wind for an eye? With cloud for shift, how will I hide? You can't explain a poem, really. It has to be its own explanation. It may have meanings laid one on top of another, and in trying to separate them or enumerate them, the totality, the magic that makes it poetry instead of prose, can be lost. The poem Question says that the body is like a house in which we live, a horse that carries us, a hound that protects us and that represents our senses. It asks how we are to do without our bodies after we die. It contains, however, other nuances of meaning, which perhaps will occur to you when I reread it. Body, my house, my horse, my hound. What will I do when you are fallen? Where will I sleep? How will I ride? What will I hunt? Where can I go without my mount all eager and quick? How will I know in thicket ahead is danger or treasure when body, my good bright dog, is dead? How will it be to lie in the sky without roof or door and wind for an eye, with cloud for shift? How will I hide? Question may have prepared us to understand the next poem, which also uses three symbols. It speaks of an hour as a hut, of a hair as a path, of sorrow as a skin, a wish. Out of an hour I built a hut, and like a Hindu sat, immune in the wind of time. From a hair I made a path and walked, and both rock and wilderness became my space and thoroughfare. With sorrow for a skin, I felt no wound. Then pleasant power like a nut ripened and split within me. Where there had been wrath, it loosened all the world to quiet noonday. My face in the rock, my name on the wildest tree, my flesh the heath of this peaceful clime. Again, only the germ of the rather complex meaning can be stated. The poem describes a way of controlling time and space, of halting pain, decay, and destruction, with the power of the mind, as the Hindu fakir supposedly does. It represents a wish to be a worker of miracles, but underneath this surface are further intimations and metaphysical suggestions. Some of them may come through to you if I read it once more. Out of an hour, I built a hut, and like a Hindu sat, immune in the wind of time. From a hair I made a path and walked, and both rock and wilderness became my space and thoroughfare. With sorrow for a skin, I felt no wound. Then pleasant power, like a nut, ripened and split within me. Where there had been wrath, it loosened all the world to quiet noonday. My face in the rock, my name on the wildest tree, my flesh the heath of this peaceful clime. After this, it will be refreshing to turn to a transparent little poem about the way a day changes into evening and then into night. A day is laid by. A day is laid by. It came to pass. Wind is drained from the willow. Dusk interlaces the grass. Out of the husk of twilight emerges the moon. This the aftermath of jaded sunset, of noon, and the sirens of bees. Day and wrath are faded. Now above the bars of lonely pastures loom the sacred stars. Spring in the Square, the final poem, was written about Washington Square here in New York, but it could be any city park on a springtime Sunday. Spring in the Square. Tree trunks intercept the eye that swoops like a bird through zigzags of green. At far end of pupil's tunnel, beads of tiny taxis roll. People move like scissored marionettes. Beneath the eyelids awning, benches slump Sunday sitters. A yawn goes mouth to mouth. Old necks slacken in the sun. Tranced fingers fold black headlines that shrink like giddy bugs in the great goblet of light. Shadow and sun interbraided, children in pendulous swings rise loose-kneed and fall, and rise loose-kneed and fall, flashing like watch fobs. The statesman's statue, all winter unmoved by snow, listens in ponderous surprise to summer's bugle. This the moment of released leaves. Innumerable green hands uncurl their puckered palms. Irrepressible grass bristles from the city's horny hide.